Later.
Good, we get the 260.
House Committee on Revenue will come to order. We have an information meeting this morning at 9 o'clock, so we'll see if we can move right along with our public hearings on the bills that we have for a public hearing today. And I assume we should just take them in order. Let's go ahead and do that. Let's open a public hearing on House Bill 2160. Mazin's on that one. Yes. Okay. Good morning.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I remember trying to tell you that I'm going to give up tobacco, but it's a very bad habit.
You and Mr. Obama, huh?
Very addictive, so they keep pulling me back to, well, as the Godfather says, every time I get out, they pull me down. So in that sense, I'm doing House Bill 2160 again. And
colleagues, this is the bill we set over from yesterday.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. Two bills we set over from yesterday. 2160 is the bill that gives the department a way to start looking into putting stamps on the moist snuff cans, and moist stuff cans, if you're familiar with them, they're just common round cans, or so, mostly round for that matter. Unlike cigarettes, where cigarettes get the stamp of the tax paid, the other tobacco products does not. And it seems like technology is either developing or in need to be developed for stamps, tax stamps, to start going into these instruments in order to indicate that the tax has been paid. So this gives the authority for the Department of Revenue, the tobacco program, to go and start looking into doing something of that sort. And I think, Mr. Chair, you would probably hear from the Department of Revenue about their process and what they're suggesting.
Yes, thank you. Let's do that. Let's hear from the department first, and then we have a we have another witness who is taking a different position, but we'll hear from him later.
Good morning, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue, and with me is Jack Ogami, who is the Business Division Administrator for the department. And Mazin mentioned that House Bill 2160 addresses stamping of other tobacco products, specifically moist snuff. There also is another piece in the bill that deals with funding of the cigarette and other tobacco tax programs. So those two components are both in House Bill 2160. And as to the funding piece, our director, Elizabeth Harshenko, gave you a preview of this issue at her Friday presentation to the committee and discussed how this proposal changes the funding stream for this tax program. In the 07-09 biennium, the department was given a direct one-time appropriation of funds, and this proposal takes us back to what used to be done with funding the program, which is the funding stream comes from the revenues of the program, a continuous appropriation. The advantage of that is it allows the legislature to deal with enforcement issues that the department identifies during the interim. And in this last interim, we did have some issues that came up. Fortunately, we were able to come back to the legislature during the February 2008 session to receive additional funding and deal with those enforcement issues. The other piece that was mentioned is, and if you have questions about the funding, or if Jack wants to speak further to that before I go on.
You covered it well. Thank you.
The other piece is the rulemaking authority to require tax stamps be affixed to moist snuff. Current law provides that cigarettes, before being sold, cigarettes when they are distributed must have a tax stamp applied to them, which shows that the tax on the cigarette has been paid. if you were in a grocery store and pick up a packet of cigarettes, there should be a stamp on the bottom of that package. That is the proof the tax has been paid. No such requirement exists for other tobacco products, including moist snuff. And as Mazna explained, this is typically an example of moist snuff is a can of Copenhagen, for example, or a can of Skoal. That is moist snuff. The proposal that we have in House Bill 2160 would allow the Department of Revenue to adopt by administrative rule a requirement that proof of tax paid must be affixed to those cans. And we are looking at different types of technology that may be available within the next year or two, such as stamps or labels or even microchips that could be applied to or inserted in a can to verify that the tax has been paid. Currently, our auditors, in trying to determine whether tax has been paid, don't have anything visual that they can look at. They review invoices, they look at records of a business to verify that the tax has actually been paid, and that's time-consuming for them. It's also a burden on the business to try to prove that they have paid that tax, and we think that this could actually benefit the business in making inspections more efficient, because if that package on the shelf has a tax stamp on it, we don't necessarily need to look at the invoices for that product, and we could restrict our inspections to other types of product without stamping. So we've been working with other states in the West, looking at available technology. Canada, as I understand it, is going to require stamping in 2010. The other states have looked at this and continue to look at it. We also think that businesses would be advantaged because you would have a more level playing field. Those that are playing by the rules and paying the tax as required would not be disadvantaged by those that are not paying the tax. So that's a brief overview of what is in the bill, and we'd be happy to try to answer any questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one quick question. Why don't we do it with all tobacco products instead of picking one?
Mr. Chair, Representative Raleigh, the reason that I think of is that the way the tax is structured now, it's on the wholesale price of the product. So, and that's for other tobacco products, not cigarettes. So the difficulty there is if you're trying to affix a stamp to a product that has varying weight or varying prices, you end up with a different amount of tax applied to that. The cans are generally uniform in weight and price. So because it's based on wholesale price, you can come up with a tax stamp that should be uniform for those products. And I don't know, Jack, whether you want to add anything.
Mr. Chair, Representative Raleigh, my understanding is that...
Oh, and would you, for the record, state your name?
Jack Ogami, Business Division Administrator at the Department of Revenue. Mr. Chair, Representative Raleigh, our understanding is that other tobacco products, the biggest share of that is moist snuff. They represent... That type of product represents approximately 80% of the value of the product that's being sold in that category, so that's the one we selected to just because of the size. We said let's take this one on, and the variations in packaging and all the rest made it much more difficult if we were trying to take on everything rather than just the big thing.
So it's an economy of scale.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes, Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just, do you feel right now that the way the department collects revenue on the moist snuff that you're, is there a gap? Is there revenue being lost, tax revenue being lost based on inadequacies of the current way you're doing it? And I realize this helps you with economies and monitoring, but is there some evidence that says, hey, I think we're losing a chunk of change here because we're not doing it correctly?
Mr. Chair, Representative Brunn, my understanding from talking to the manager of our tax program is that most of the challenges they're having right now is in the area of other tobacco products, primarily because there is no indicator, and that makes it very hard to for our field to validate. So yes, there is.
But nothing that's been quantified.
No, sir, we haven't quantified that.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I inferred from your comments that there are no other states doing this at this point. Is that correct? You mentioned that Canada is looking at doing this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Springer, you're correct. There are no other states that are doing it. Right now what we're doing is the western states have created a task force where we worked on seeing if there was agreement that we needed to do something about this problem, and we agreed that there was. They started talking about what might be a process to go through, making sure that whatever we came up with as a stamping technology was uniform and that industry could agree with that. And we thought we came up with a framework for further discussion, so we took the proposal to the Federation of Tax Administrators, which all 50 states belong to, and they have a tobacco products section. And so right now we're participating in a national discussion about what the technology might be and the way it would be implemented. And very shortly, I believe, we'll be inviting industry to the table to begin talking about what those steps would be.
Okay. Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
So on page 4, if I'm understanding this correctly, this act applied to moist snuff distributed on or after January 1st, 2010. And I heard the comment that there may be technology to do this in the next year or two, and they're working on that. I guess my concern, and it's probably more of a concern than a question, is are we going to enact something that at some point we don't even have the technology to facilitate?
Mr. Chair, Representative Springer, I think that is the proposal that is before you. Obviously, there won't be a regular session again until 2011. If there's progress made and technology is available within the next year or two, it will take us some time to adopt and to ramp up our process. We felt that bringing this to you now for your consideration might save us time in that process, whereas if we waited until the technology is actually in place and come back to you in 2011, we may have lost a year or two when this could actually be implemented. Thank you.
And there was another, Representative Berger.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to visualize this process, and as I just heard testimony, if you haven't got it yet, you're asking to come up with a process, but for instance, this is wholesale. It's taxed at the wholesale level. Is that what my understanding?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, the tax is paid by the distributor, and it is based on the wholesale price of the product.
Okay, that's different. So, I mean, it's always been a wonder to me that you stamp cigarette packs. What happens when they come in cartons? How do you get that stamp on there? You uncarton them and...
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger. Please, Jack, go ahead, explain.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, industry has standardized the stamp. Virtually every state that sells cigarettes puts on a very similar stamp. They all use similar machinery, so they've got agreement, and so the cartons of cigarettes come in, the machine opens up the bottom of the carton, and it automatically applies the stamp to the 10 packs of cigarettes. It goes through the machine further, and it reseals it, and it's ready to distribute. So they've standardized the process, and so it's fairly efficient.
Okay, so that gets at my question. If we're the only state doing this, then that process has to start all over again for this different product. Is that correct? And there is no state that has a process whereby industry stamps this. But the states are working on coming up with something. Is that basically what you're saying? And this bill would authorize you to come up with something.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, you're correct, yes.
Mr. Chair, I'm wondering if we aren't a little premature on this. Thank you.
I'd like to follow up on that line of questioning a little bit. The way I read this bill, it authorizes you to determine if verification is practicable and helpful to the administration of the tax. That's on page 4, lines 17 and 18. Would there be any problem as far as you can see now with an additional requirement that the department would have to make a finding that other states were also doing this sort of thing or were prepared to do this kind of thing? given that you're obviously contemplating working with several other states in the process, as a precursor to actually moving ahead, that other states were also moving ahead?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe that would be a problem. That I believe that's our operating intent.
Right. It doesn't actually say that in the bill, though, does it?
No, sir.
No. Okay. Did you want to comment any more on the other issue of funding administrative expenses?
Mr. Chair, the only comment I have is that the current way we're funding the program with a separate appropriation has created some challenges in terms of flexibility. When we left the 07 session with our separate appropriation for the program, one of the things we found was that there was this emerging problem with untaxed sales over the Internet. We didn't have funding to address that. We thought about going to the e-board, but because it was a separate appropriation, we understood that e-board couldn't address it. Fortunately, the 08 session was available, and we were able to make our case to that special session and gain funding. I believe by doing that, we obtained about $180,000 to $200,000 for the Internet operations, and we've returned, I think, approximately $1 million, just shy of $1 million in terms of tax billings related to the untaxed sale of cigarettes over the Internet. So the flexibility is important to any type of a program that's this magnitude. I think we generate, under current law, we're going to be generating $450 million next biennium. So a certain amount of flexibility is desired.
And that's, if I understand it, that's what's in Section 2 of the bill on the first page, or is that something, am I looking in the wrong place?
Mr. Chairman, you're correct. It is Section 2, and I believe it's also in Section 3 for the other tobacco tax program.
All right. And what limitations are there on this authority? Does this have to go through a legislative appropriation? Then it just simply defines a funding stream, or does somebody else determine what the expenses for administration amount to?
Mr. Chairman, it's my understanding that the agency still goes to the Ways and Means Committee for limitation.
Thank you. So the Ways and Means, there's still a budget bill,
sir,
that authorizes you to spend money on administration even with this authorization.
Yes, sir.
This simply defines the place that you're getting the money from.
Correct.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Mazin.
Just to go through this quickly, Mr. Chair, as you know, tobacco programs, they're both cigarettes and OTP, other tobacco programs. The Department of Revenue collect the tax. In the past, it used to transmit all the taxes collected to the different uses that are specified in law. Then what it used to be before the year 2003 and 2005, that the department would get its budget through the appropriation process through the general fund. So the general fund only was paying for all the other uses that the tobacco was getting or going to. With the coming of the task force, the tobacco task force, there was a certain very direct appropriation to the task force. Last session in the 2007, what was the new thing that started being introduced is that we start funding the tobacco program off the top of the revenue stream that comes in. This is consistent with all other funding mechanisms that occur in the state, where the collection mechanism for any amounts of revenue actually comes off the top first, and then it starts, the net revenue gets to be distributed through the distribution process and the revenue stream. Now, this puts it in par with everybody else, if you will, and in the same time, it makes the appropriation continuous in the sense that all the amounts that out there, they could be used continuously for that purpose. However,
The budgets either get continuous appropriation, or they don't get continuous appropriation. They go get appropriation from Ways and Means, or you get continuous appropriation and you go to Ways and Means and get a limitation. So they will be getting a limitation from Ways and Means, even though they still have the continuous appropriation for the amounts of revenue. This allows a program to actually live off the top rather than only going and waiting for the general fund appropriation.
Thank you. That's very helpful. That also helps to explain to me why this bill doesn't have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, since they get their cut at it through the limitation process.
That is correct, Mr. Chair. They don't get any new money out of this.
Right.
This only just identifies where the funding mechanism for the program is going to be.
Thank you. That's very helpful. Representative Bentz.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions on Section 6. The first, is it normal for all distributors to prepay the tax for all distributors of tobacco products, or is this an isolated case for prepayment? In other words, is the normal collection of the tax at point of retail sale, or is the and then the payment, or is it always that the distributor prepays the tax and then collects it from the ultimate buyer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, my understanding from the way the other tobacco products tax works is that the distributor pays the tax in advance based on the wholesale price. What ends up happening is that tax is due monthly. Unlike cigarettes, they buy the stamps, and the minute they buy the stamps, we've got the cash in hand. So that's the difference between the two programs, if you're asking for how it's different from cigarettes?
Currently, yes, Representative Bentz.
Thank you. I just want to make sure that this type of tobacco product is being treated the same as others. It sounds like it is when it comes to prepayment.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, yes.
Okay, and the second question. The problem that gives rise to this proposed solution, that is fixing the verification of payment, would suggest that we're having a problem now. And what is that problem exactly? What prompts this proposal? What's wrong with the current way we're doing it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, the challenge we face is that our inspectors will go into a retail outlet and cigarettes, they can just look at the packs of cigarettes and there's the stamp on the bottom of the cigarette and it shows that the tax has been paid. If they go to the chewing tobacco cans, there's no evidence. So there's a law out there that requires retailers to hold up to five years worth of their invoices so that our inspectors can go in and try to match them up, but there's no identifier on the can, so it's very difficult for them to match up the can with the invoice. So the legitimate retailers that pay the tax, I don't think they have any problem. The challenge is that there are people who are bringing in untaxed product, and we can't tell that it's untaxed. We have to send an auditor into the distributor, and they have to become very intrusive in the process. They have to dig through shipping records, receiving records, and to make sure how many cans of chewing tobacco went to which distributor. So it's a very expensive, intrusive process to document compliance. We believe that by adding some type of a payment indicator on the can, we could eliminate all of those steps.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. As a follow-up on that, I'm wondering why this issue is coming up now, and a couple of things occur to me. I don't know which any of them are true. One possibility that occurs to me is that moist snuff as a percentage of tobacco sales is increasing. I don't know whether that's true or not. Why are you and other states pursuing this issue now as compared to 10 years ago or some other time?
Mr. Chair, my understanding is that you are correct that the industry reports indicates that the use of moist snuff is increasing. We also find that based on the information from our field inspectors, that's the area where we're finding the most noncompliance. It's very hard to validate that tax has been paid, and so people are taking advantage of that. And it's not just an Oregon situation. It's happening in the regions where moist snuff consumption is prevalent. So the western states have a particular interest in trying to level the playing field. We've also gotten comments from various distributors that they would like us to try to do something to level the playing field in the area of moist snuff.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, yes, Representative.
Can I, this might be a chicken and the egg kind of question, but it seems to me that we could get at this problem two ways, and I'm wondering if the problem isn't really about how we collect or audit the taxation, but rather how it's assessed. And if we assess the tax similarly to the way we do cigarettes as opposed to doing it on the wholesale price, whether or not some of the problems that you foresee in actually making the stamping mechanism work and whatnot would go away. So I'm wondering if the problem isn't really on how we're assessing the taxation as opposed to how we're administering or auditing it. Could you speak to that? Does that make sense or not?
Mr. Chair, Representative Call, there's two, throughout the country, there's two ways that people are taxing moist snuff. One is based as a percentage of the wholesale value, and the other is a merging method based on weight. How much tobacco is in the product? With the different stamping alternatives that we're looking at, most of them are compatible with either method of taxation. So they're
okay.
Mazza?
Mr. Representative Hall, the way, of course, the other tobacco product is being taxed is by wholesale price, and you're right, it's not per unit, so there is no unit tax in that sense. As in cigarettes, remember there is the mill. How many mills are you levying on each cigarette? That is not the case in other tobacco product. However, this process is not necessarily a solution for that issue. Even if you have a tax per unit of moist snuff, you still don't have a mechanism for verification whether the tax is being paid or not. This is a verification mechanism in the sense that who is paying and is this product being taxed and being verified that it is being taxed. I think this whole issue, the genesis of it, comes from what's so-called the Tobacco Task Force a few years ago. The Tobacco Task Force, what it found when it was done in order to investigate what kind of taxes are being lost to internet, to contraband, to all the different ways of losing the tax. What it found after a number of years of multi-agency, the state police, AG, Department of Revenue, many other agencies, what it found is there is a lot less illegal sales of cigarettes than there is in other tobacco products. And the reason for that is it's not very apparent that the other tobacco products have this mechanism of being verified. You cannot flip the pack or the cigar and see the tax is paid or not. I think what they're trying to do in here is take care of that issue, whether the mechanism or the method of taxation was easier or not. This is will make it easier for the Department of Revenue or the tobacco program to be able to go anywhere and look at a lot easier ways first of all getting the tax prehend and then verifying it, just as it has proved to be a lot more verifiable when it comes to cigarettes. So it's trying to make that verification mechanism more compliant, if you will.
Let me follow up on the line of questioning we've been hearing. One of the points that you made a few minutes ago is that there are some distributors who want you to proceed with something like this. I wonder if you could provide us with some additional information on that point, perhaps not today, but later. The second issue I'm wondering about is it occurs to me that if there is a problem with enforcement in some part of the country, that it may make sense for many states to act at about the same time, even if an individual state in that group is not experiencing a particular compliance problem, because once you tie things down in the state with a problem today, the problem might shift around somewhere else. I mean, the people who cheat on taxes like this tend to be fairly opportunistic, I think. I'm getting head nods from the witnesses. Okay, all right. Thank you. Is there anything else you'd like to add to what you've told us already?
No, sir.
All right. We have Richard Kosasan is here, and my understanding is that Brian Berry, who signed up yesterday, is not here. He wasn't able to come back, and you can verify that if that's true, Richard.
Mr. Chair, Richard Kosasan, I'm kind of sitting in this morning for Brian Berry.
Thank you.
Who was here yesterday morning, and Brian Berry is with Coremark International in Portland, Oregon, a distributor, and he is on a plane to the East Coast this morning and could not return. I think, as previously mentioned, we view the piece of legislation as somewhat premature in nature. It clearly modifies the Department of Revenue's authority with respect to other tobacco products. It modifies how the Department of Revenue is reimbursed for expenses with respect to the administration of the cigarette tax revenue program, as well as the other tobacco products tax. And it extends rulemaking authority extends rulemaking authority, again, above and beyond that provided in current law. To address a couple of issues, I would encourage the committee to take a look at the Tobacco Products Tax Act, and specifically with respect to existing and current requirements. One, let's keep in mind that a distributor in the state of Oregon is clearly licensed. Department of Revenue has control over that license. But I would encourage the committee to take a look at existing statutory provisions found in ORS 323-538. In terms of trying to answer the question, are other tobacco products readily controlled and monitored? Can they be verified in terms of movement from a manufacturer to a distributor, wholesaler, to a retailer? Very quickly, Mr. Chair, a wholesale invoice would include the name and address of the seller, the name and address of the purchaser, the date of the sale of tobacco products, the quantity of product, description of tobacco products, the price paid for tobacco products, any discount applied, the applicable license identification number, a certified statement by the distributor of the tobacco products that all taxes due under the Act have been or will be paid, and any other information the Department of Revenue may prescribe by rule. The provisions continue to extend similar provisions to the subsequent purchaser and subsequent seller of other tobacco products. So, first of all, I would encourage the committee to take a look at the first question, the initial question of the administration of the current statutory provisions we have. In terms of actual requirements or the establishment of a requirement to require the placement of a stamp or indicia on other tobacco products, Mr. Berry was going to provide some examples. And there is a case of Kodiak, 5 cans wrapped in plastic. And there is a case of Copenhagen wrapped in plastic. What's interesting is that is how they are delivered from the manufacturer to the distributor. The distributor would have one option, to break open that container and try to affix a stamp or some other tax identification number to each individual can. If one were to argue that equipment is available and technology is available, then the secondary question is the cost of such equipment. If the equipment is $50,000, $100,000, $150,000, I think what you do is you jeopardize the standing of small distributors in the state of Oregon who simply could not afford the capital outlay for that piece of equipment. Therefore, they discontinue a category that they have maintained for years. But in actuality, the problem here is basic packaging and control. The other question here, too, is the attachment of a tack stamp. You have one, a corrugated container here, and here you have a plastic container. Will the tack stamp, perhaps available, affixed to a corrugated container and not a plastic container? So I think in and of itself, that's problematic in nature. As previously identified by the Department of Revenue, if this is a question of control of the tax, and we believe taxes are lost through the Internet, I think that's a completely different question. Address the Internet question, but the question you have before you in terms of 2160, I think, presents a completely different view and does not address that Internet question. In terms of the tobacco tax compliance issue and the task force, we would strongly encourage an enhancement of the task force, additional dollars to the task force. We were involved, I believe, 7 or 8 years ago with the establishment of that task force at that time, both on the other tobacco product side as well as the cigarette side. I think you could demonstrate that the state of Oregon was losing legitimate tax revenues. I do not believe that is the case today. Mr. Berry provided some examples in terms of tracking and following product, and he took the month of January, which we just completed, and he can pull up instantly a description of exactly the product that was purchased by himself, the original purchaser, exactly where it went, the quantities, and the exact product, and all prices. So in terms of controlling, following, identifying the product, again, from the manufacturer level to the distributor level to the retail level, I think the tools are out there now. I think I would recommend, and I think Mr. Berry would recommend, that rather than take this bill forward, let's wait to see what other technologies are out there and then address the issue. And with that, Mr. Chair, one additional question I think deserves clarification. In terms of the incidence of the tax is on the distribution, but the tax is basically paid in arrears. It is paid at the end of the first month after the calendar quarter. So the tax due from a distributor would be due at the end of April for the first quarter, in this case, first quarter 2009. So the tax is basically paid after the fact. In terms of cigarette side, the tax is paid prior to the fact in terms of a distributor actually purchasing the stamp prior to the stamping of a cigarette carton. Those provisions are 323.510. So I think that deserves somewhat of a clarification. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'm certain I did not do as good a job as Mr. Berry, but in his stead, and I appreciate your kindness.
Thank you. Questions? Very much appreciate your testimony. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is there anyone else who would like to be heard today on House Bill 2160? I don't see anyone, so we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2160. Find my agenda here. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2048. Are you on that one, too?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
As I said, tobacco is a hard thing to give up. So House Bill 2048 still deals with this issue.
also a department bill, and it grants the authority for the Department of Revenue to be able to go and examine places where products might be hidden or put away. This, I think, comes from the need of auditors and inspectors to go into places to get that authority to be able to go into these spots that they might suspect having products in. This is almost an enabling enforcement type of legislation, and in that sense, we can't see exactly if there is a revenue impact. Probably also doesn't have that fiscal impact because of the inspectors are already on the ground. So it might be just basically to increase that enforcement mechanism, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And we have the department ready to be heard. Ms. Buchanan.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart. Members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. Mr. Chair, I do need to just clarify, we worked with Representative Schaffler during the interim, and this bill was introduced in his committee during the interim. We did identify some issues with the language and presented those to the committee, and I believe the committee administrator has sent those comments to this committee. So we do have a couple of concerns about the bill as it is drafted, mm-hmm. and would appreciate an opportunity to continue to work on that language.
Thank you. While we're here and while we're in public hearing, why don't you explain to us what the object of the bill is and what you're hoping to accomplish with it, and then if it's the committee's desire to go ahead with it, we'll have that information when the amendments come back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My understanding is that the bill is to clarify the department's authority to inspect premises where cigarettes and other tobacco products are sold. During the meetings in the interim, the discussion with was around the authority that's currently granted to the Oregon Liquor Control Commission and their ability to enter premises and inspect. And I believe the intent of this bill was to more closely model what those agents are able to do. So the bill as it's drafted, you'll notice on line 11, authorizes us to inspect areas where patrons are permitted to be present. We have that authority now, so what we're really looking for is the ability to inspect areas where patrons are not allowed to be, areas that are off-limits perhaps to customers. And then also there is no notice requirement in current law. On line 14, there's a 72-hour notice requirement that probably would, in some cases, act to defeat the purpose of an inspection, which is to show up and look for product that is untapped.
Okay. Thank you. Questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Call.
So just so I understand real clearly what we're talking about here. So let's say somebody has cigarettes that are untaxed, say, in the black market, and they're selling them out of the back of the store as opposed to the public area of the store. Your guys couldn't go into that area of the store to inspect the cigarettes to make sure that the tax was paid. Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Chair, Representative Call, my understanding is that if we were to go to a retailer to mm-hmm. do an inspection and a retailer refused entry to a location on the basis that it's not their storage area, it belongs to someone else, we don't have any authority under the law to say we'd like to take a look at that anyway, if you don't mind. So this would give us the authority to look at areas even though they're closed in a given business location.
Is it your intention that the bill would apply to premises controlled by people who are not licensed as well as those who are licensed? Despite what the bill says, I understand you're working on amendments.
Mr. Chairman, yes, I do believe that was the intent of that, because we often do have people who don't have a distributor. I shouldn't say often. At times, we will have people who are not licensed distributors who are selling product, so we would want to be able to inspect that location as well.
And is there any requirement now that you have some kind of reason to believe that the premises might contain untaxed materials or records about untaxed materials?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know the answer to that question, but I will find that out.
You hear the old criminal lawyer thinking about search and seizure law when I ask that question. And I know that there are exceptions to search and seizure law for health inspections and a variety of other things. I don't know whether they apply to inspections for the purpose of collecting a tobacco tax. I simply don't know.
Nor do I, sir.
All right.
Find that out.
Thank you. Anything else with this witness? We have one other witness who signed up.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Sean Miller. And is there anyone else who'd like to be heard today on this bill? Sean, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Sean Miller here today on behalf of the Northwest Grocery Association. We also worked in the interim with Representative Schaffler and the Interim Business Committee on this legislation and some other tobacco compliance bills that have been introduced in the past and are here today in support of House Bill 2048. And as Mr. Buchanan mentioned, some amendments need to be crafted, I think, to correct the original intent of the bill. And the way we understood the bill and in the discussions in the interim is, yes, in fact, the Department of Justice, who actually tries to prosecute a lot of the cases, has been given indication where there may be a product available at certain stores, for instance, where and the scam I think that's often referred to is someone walks up to the counter and says, I want a carton of Marlboros, and they'll say, I'll be right back. And they go into the back room. Into a locked cabinet, bring them out, and then no one knows the difference between the stamps. You heard some of the compliance issues in the last hearing of whether those were stamped or unstamped. And what this basically accomplishes is when someone comes in on an inspection, they're able to inspect the entire premises. Currently in grocery stores, for instance, there's a service center. Right now, they normally just inspect the service center. If there's any indication of another store that may be having a storeroom or something out back where they may be storing product, they don't really have the authority to go in there. Now, the OLCC on liquor inspections or alcohol inspections does have that authority. And so what we said was, I think it's reasonable, especially if you're trying to inspect retail establishments, that you have the same authority within the Oregon Liquor Control Commission and how those inspectors and tobacco enforcement. So our intent was, let's go ahead and allow them that authority. The bill, though, does say that in line 11, says where patrons are permitted, and I think we have agreed that it should be where patrons are permitted or not permitted, because it could be a locked storeroom. The other issue is the 72-hour notice. That does defeat the purpose of a random inspection. If someone's doing something wrong,
that gives me a lot of time to fix that.
I think they can clear out the product in 24 hours, I would think. And so we are working with Ms. Buchanan on some of the definitions that they've come up with on premises to make really clear what that means. And we hope to come back to the committee with a bill that we all agree on and would ask the committee to adopt that at that time. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Great. And I'll say this both to you and to the department. At that time, it would be really helpful to have an understanding of the parallelism between this bill mm-hmm. and the current authority of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, just to deal with that niggling old thought from many years ago about search and seizure law.
Mm-hmm.
That would be very helpful for me. That's anything else? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. Anyone else would like to be heard today on House Bill 2048.
Mr. Chair, is the criminal lawyer is the lawyer who's or the lawyer who does with the crime?
Thank you very much. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2048. We do expect an information hearing in just a few minutes. I think I should recess. All right, let's recess until 9:00.
Can it be that we're ahead of schedule?
No, we're actually behind schedule. The House Committee on Revenue will come back to order. The next item on our agenda is the information meeting from the on the Debt Advisory Commission report. Mr. Treasurer.
Four one. Years since.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. Thank you for having us today. For the record, I am State Treasurer Ben Westland, and obviously sitting with me is Laura Lockwood McCall, our very dedicated, energetic, and talented Director of the Debt Management Division. You know, when we talk about Oregon's fiscal structure, it's a very broad base of financial concerns. How we spend, how we raise money, how we save, and this is the reason we are here today. Also, for how we borrow and for what. Public debt is an important tool that can serve two worthy goals. We can stimulate the economy today through job creation, and we can invest in Oregon's long-term viability and build a better Oregon for tomorrow with better roads, better public services, a better quality of life for all Oregonians. And also, and this is sometimes overlooked, the value of borrowing to pay for long-term capital improvements is that people who benefit from those projects will help to pay the cost of those projects into the future. But bonds and bonding are also a tool that must be used very carefully with a great deal of discretion. Simply put, just like a family, they, as a state, must avoid taking on too much debt, and so must Oregon. The great news is that we can invest wisely for the future, but we must do it in a way that doesn't jeopardize our credit rating and doesn't require too heavy a debt load of financing into the future to repay those bonds. It is, as many things in life, a balance. So the question inevitably comes up, how much is too much, how much is prudent, and just as importantly, how much is too little? Today, we are pleased to present to you the findings of the Oregon State Debt Policy Advisory Commission. This five-member commission helps to determine the limits for general fund and lottery-backed debt based on, and here's a key concept, key criteria, based on anticipated revenue and prudent fiscal management. I am the chair of that commission, which also includes two very distinguished legislative members, your very own Chair Barnhart, and a member who has served on that commission for over a decade, Senator Metzger. You know, one note of caution. Although we have set a prudent limit, that does not mean that that figure is set in concrete and that it is a goal to be attained. It is a function of state revenue, and as that number changes, so will our limits. And also, please keep in mind that the Commission is not, absolutely not, recommending that the legislature borrow up to our capped limits. Like a family, it is not a bad thing to sometimes use a credit card, but you can jeopardize your credit rating if you use it too frequently and you max it out. In tough economic times, obviously such as those that this legislature must wrestle with for the rest of this session, in tough economic times, people look to bonding as an economic catalyst. I support that purpose, but we need to know how much is too much. And that is why I'm pleased to help start this conversation today. I look forward to working with you this session. Please consider our office a resource to help you with your decisions. My office is always open. And I think most of you have my cell phone, so you know how to get a hold of me. And I'd encourage that. The, we are all going to do this together. These are challenges that we have faced before. And one of the aspects of Oregon today, as opposed to when many on this committee went through this before, I firmly believe that today Oregon is more governable, not less, and that we have additional capacity to meet these challenges. At this juncture, I'd like to turn this over to Laura Lockwood McCall. And if I may, Mr. Chair, excuse myself unless the committee has any questions that I'd be happy to answer.
Any questions for the Treasurer? Thank you, sir. We appreciate your attendance here this morning.
I appreciate your work on the commission, Phil, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Berger.
With permission, I'd like to comment that I had a meeting with the Treasurer recently to discuss the 529 plan, and I would encourage all of you to go into his office. He has the biggest rattlesnake in there I've ever seen in my life, and it scared me to death. So I'm giving you fair warning when you walk in there.
This is a live rattlesnake?
Well, it looks live to me.
Don't
and
tell
it's
him.
You got to see it. Go in and see him.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Mr. Treasurer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Committee.
Good morning, for the record. Laura Lockwood McCall, Director of the Debt Management Division in the State Treasurer's Office. I would first ask the Chair how much time you've scheduled for me. I have a lot of slides, and I can make it brief or long on the committee's work this morning.
Well, we do have one more bill to hear. We'll either hear it today or we will hear it tomorrow. And so you take the time that you need in order to do it, and expect that if you go too fast, you may get interrupted with a question.
I'm more than happy to take questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'm dying.
So, as Treasurer Westland mentioned, the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission met twice this past, during the month of January, to review the report that we just released. This annual capacity report is required.
Let me interrupt you just for a second, and I've just been told that, in fact, the witnesses who are here, were here for House Bill 2148, are expecting to be back on Thursday, and so I'm going to postpone the public hearing on House Bill 2148 until Thursday. Is that the notice you need? It is. All right. Please, go ahead.
Okay. For those who haven't seen a presentation before, this is an annual requirement under state law to prepare this report. It provides legislature and as well as the governor a framework for measuring and monitoring our debt position. Now, we focused very specifically on the general fund supported debt and the lottery-backed debt. We have a variety of other types of debt that I'll show you in a minute that really have their own self-supporting limits. But the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission reports to date have focused on these two big categories since they're so integral to the overall budget process of the state. There's these four major types of debt, as I mentioned. General obligation bonds can be...
I think you can back off from the mic just a little bit, and
okay.
It won't distort.
How's that? Is that
won't distort quite so much.
Okay. Excuse me. I think I'm just getting feedback, so it sounds weird. The general obligation bonds are allowed under the Constitution. We have an absolute debt limit in the Constitution. We cannot borrow more than $50,000 without a carve-out. And so general obligation bonds have all been approved by voters. And there's a whole variety of different types in the report. You can read about all the different categories under Article 11. You'll often hear 11G, 11F. But these are just all various carve-outs that voters have approved. Some of these are general fund-supported GO bonds, and there's many others that are not general fund-supported. They're self-supporting. For example, Veterans Mortgage Loan Program, Energy Loan Program, and often DEQ loans can be self-supporting. We have direct revenue bonds where it is not the full faith and credit of the state, but rather these are different revenue streams that we can pledge to investors for repayment. For example, highway user tax bonds or lottery revenue bonds. We have appropriation credits, which do not go through the Constitution. They're not full faith and credit, but we still promise to pay. We promise to appropriate annually. Certificates of participation, which is a big piece of that overall appropriation credit, is something that gets talked a lot about during the session. We finance a large percentage of our prisons, our mental health facilities, and office buildings in the state using the COPs. And then finally, we have conduit revenue bonds, which is simply an opportunity the state has under federal law to finance various things that are allowed under federal tax law, but there's no faith in credit. It's not our revenues. We're not on the hook for any of it, but we help facilitate things that the private sector needs. For example, we do small business loans through industrial development revenue bonds. We sell financings for nonprofits through the Oregon Facilities Authority, and we do multifamily housing conduits through Oregon Housing and Community Services.
Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the purpose of the conduit revenue bond is what? Why is the state involved? There must be some reason.
Under federal law, there's a number of things that are called private activities, but that have good public purposes. So, for example, multifamily housing. There's a belief that that's a good thing. So we are really a vehicle through which various entities can come in and get their bonds financed, and there's still a tax exemption associated with it. However, again, there's no credit. It's not our revenue streams. So there's certain categories of these types of bonds, and we've, over the years, had various programs in these three agencies that I just mentioned to facilitate that.
Yeah, yes, please.
The tax exemption is at the federal level. Is there also a tax exemption at the state level?
Yes, there is.
Follow up.
Yes.
And then so when one of these bonds is issued, there has to be some spending decision made. Is that made at the legislative level, or where is that decision made?
In terms of the tax expenditure, if
yes,
you will?
Yes, the expenditure that goes with the issuance of bonds.
Each year, as part of the overall legislative process, there's what's called the bond bill, which is kind of equivalent to the sort of which we'll get into the caps, because you'll see that the debt limits that are under the Constitution are quite large. But then the legislature picks a number. So, for example, they'll say Oregon Facilities Authority has, you can't bond more than a certain amount per biennium. And you'll see that for all the different types of programs and bonding throughout the state. So whether you realize it or not, you're making a decision, if you will, by the way you do the bonding bill in terms of how much every agency that can sell bonds, how much they can sell.
Thank you.
if I understand it, in effect what's happening is the federal government has decided they're going to allow the states to figure out which ones of these public good kinds of things ought to be done. And then we've decided that we're going to use the expertise we already have in the Treasurer's office to make this all happen. Is that another way of saying the same thing, I hope?
Yes and no.
Okay.
Through the Chair Barnhart.
I'm glad
there's
I asked that.
There's a variety of other agencies and entities around the state that also sell bonds.
Yes.
And so while the legislature has asked and over the years designed our system so there's centralized debt management at the state level, there's probably a dozen, 20, 30 hospital facilities authorities that also sell conduit revenue bonds in different counties. And so it's not completely isolated in the treasurer's office. Mm-hmm. So, you could put a cap on Oregon Facilities Authority, but other hospitals that are nonprofits can go sell bonds through all these other hospital facilities authorities. So there really isn't a one-stop cap. It's just the state agencies have this type of financial controls placed on them.
Right.
Cities, counties, school districts also sell bonds. So you can't quite say that the legislature completely controls how much of that tax expenditure is being generated, because it's really determined by lots of local governments as well. And there really is a lot more local government debt outstanding than there is state debt. There's, last time I checked, about $19 billion in local government debt in the state of Oregon. Not every penny of it is tax exempt. There may be some taxable in there because there's some pension obligation bonds. That probably represents a couple billion dollars of it. We have about $9 billion, of which roughly $7 billion is tax exempt, because the pension obligation bonds we sold as well were taxable,
mm-hmm.
just to give you a sense of scale.
Right. So are you saying that school bonds for school buildings are conduit?
No, they're not. But the question is deeper than just conduit.
Right.
It's all when you look at the benefit, if you will, the tax
sure.
expenditure because of the tax exemption, whether it's conduit or general obligation. I mean, it becomes the same difference.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The point I wanted to get at is the actual cost to the state of Oregon for allowing, facilitating a school bond, let's say, Am I correct? And please, this is an actual point I'm most interested in. If someone floats a $3 million bond to build or $10 million bond to build something, they get the tax exemption. Is it then that instead of the folks' money that buy those bonds being placed into a taxable account, and instead is placed into one that's not?
Well,
is that how it costs
well,
us money?
Well, people do buy tax-exempt bonds, and it's the interest on those bonds. Okay, so you know, I have these big, large numbers, and you're thinking, oh, my goodness, but we have to think about, well, what's the annual debt service? Okay, and yes, that interest for those investors who've chosen to purchase that tax-exempt instrument, that interest would be free if it's tax-exempt from both federal and state taxation.
And, of course, they're willing to accept a lower rate of interest because it's tax-free.
That's correct. Unfortunately, in the current market, they get a better rate of interest than one would believe, given the current Treasury rates. But in general, that's the way that the market works.
Thank you.
So this is a snapshot for the last decade of these major categories of debt that I just mentioned. And what you can see is that we've gone from just over about $4 billion in total state debt to something north of $9 billion as of the end of fiscal year 08. And I want to make two observations. We did sell pension obligation bonds, as I mentioned, in 2003, late 2003, which is a 2004 fiscal year. We did this because we were paying an unfunded liability to PERS at that time of 8% per year. That's the standard calculation, and we were able to sell taxable general obligation bonds, voter approved, for just around 5.75%. Now, we took an off-balance sheet liability, and we put it on our balance sheet, which increased our debt ratios, and I'll show you some slides in that moment, but recognize that in either case, it was a long-term liability of the state. So, in essence, we were refinancing a long-term liability at a lower cost. But it does mean, because of the way this chart is designed, that it appears that our debt ratios really shot up, at least from a public capital markets perspective. The other thing that you should note is that other general obligation bonds of the state actually probably declined slightly over that period, although new authorizations of general obligation bonds were being approved by the legislature. And that's because we're paying off debt as well as issuing debt. So we're not quite at steady state, but there is sort of an off and on. We try and keep our average life of our bonds in the 20-25-year range, and that allows us to recycle that debt capacity. The area where there's really been the biggest growth is in the red area, and that's the direct revenue bond program, and there's two pieces to that. One is that the cost of housing has gone up. So the single-family mortgages that Oregon Housing does for first-time homebuyers, the average mortgage has increased over that decade as construction costs have increased as well. And the other piece of it, of course, is the big Oregon Transportation Improvement and Act, which was OTIA. And so we've sold, at this point, $1.8 billion of the overall $2.6 billion authorization for OTIA. So you're starting to see those things starting to impact us as we go through the decade. As I said, though, we can't really look at overall debt in terms of coming up with what's appropriate for the state, but rather let's look at the general fund debt and a lottery-backed debt, and those are the two things that this report really focuses on each year. Over the time, the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission has come to a goal of trying to keep the general fund debt service, and this is opposed to debt, but actual debt service, annual payments, at no greater than 5% of general fund revenues. There's no magic to the number. Many states around the country try and keep in that range. Some states go a little higher. You don't automatically get downgraded, but I think it's a good rule of thumb because as revenues decline in a tough economic situation, this becomes a fixed cost in your budget. It's not negotiable. You can't do across-the-board cuts and include debt service. So you don't want your debt service to grow too large as a percentage of your overall operating budget because it's not going to be cuttable in a downturn. At the same token, if you have too low a number, then you're probably not investing in the kind of infrastructure as a society that you need in order to be productive to generate the revenues that you need to kind of keep the budget going. And so, for better or for worse, the 5% target has been our watchword as we do these forecasts going forward. And I'll talk about some...
That's,
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Were you going to tell us where we are in relation to that?
I sure am.
Thank you.
Okay. And I'll come back to talk about some of these other types of debt in a moment. But let's start with general fund supported debt. This is currently the types of bonds that are considered general fund supported. It includes the higher ed 11G bonds, which involve a 50% match, and then the general fund picks up the other half of the cost of the project and the debt service. Community college bonds, which have the similar type of a match requirement. And you'll note that I have percentages for some of the other general obligation bonds. And the reason is we've gone in and we've done sort of careful analysis of what portion of all these different types of bonds are paid for through the general fund and what's paid for through other sources. Historically, alternative energy bonds have been 100% self-supporting. But in 2005 and 2007, the legislature, and I think actually the 2009 legislature has decided to do this as well, has begun to use these bonds to do energy projects at the universities. And they're really no longer self-supporting. Although energy savings will help pay the debt service, at the end of the day, the general fund's on the hook for, we forecast into the future, about 15%, and it could grow, of these bonds. So we're starting to add this in. Now, it doesn't represent a huge amount of additional debt service because the overall program is not very large relative to some of the other bond programs. But I mostly wanted to point out that we're trying to fine-tune this this report so that we can give decision makers a real clear picture. Conversely, we looked at certificates of participation. Historically, we've always assumed 100% of COPs, which is over $1 billion, was paid for by the general fund. Well, DAS went through an analysis, and point of fact, approximately 85% of COPs are really general fund supported, with the balance coming out of the revenue streams of non-general fund agencies, which actually brings back a fair amount of capacity. So in that analysis. Now, I'd also point out we're going to probably be starting to issue general obligation bonds under the two seismic rehabilitation programs. At this point, we're assuming they'll be general fund back because we haven't heard about any loan repayments. We're hearing that the program is being conceived as a grant program. So all said and done, as of June 30th, we had roughly $2.5 billion of general fund-backed debt in the state. This is a picture to show you sort of the components that you were just asking about, Representative Vance. So it just shows you when it jumped up.
Where does that 2.5 fit on the 5%?
I'm going to get to that. First, I was just showing you the components, and you can see that the pension obligation bonds that we just issued in 2004 really jumped up that number. And since that time, and we sort of stated roughly a little bit over $2 billion. What's really interesting as we did the forecast this year, because we do a six-year forecast. We look at 6 years' worth of general fund revenues. We look at all the existing debt service as well. We look at what is the legislature authorized that we assume will be issued. And then we say, okay, how much capacity? And what you can see is where the line is going downward. We're paying off the appropriation deficit bonds that were issued in 2003, the purple at the top, in this six-year period. And that's bringing in a fair amount of capacity that we haven't had available to us in the past. So I think that's why you'll see in a moment how much debt capacity we do have over the six-year horizon. Simple, this is a math formula. These are the things, just a list of the things that the legislature approved. Now, this report was published prior to the economic stimulus.
Do you plan to talk about the appropriation deficit bonds again?
Not unless you have more questions.
No, just to point out that's the purple area, isn't it?
That's correct.
Yeah, just to point out that that's the effect of not being able to close the budget, the 2001-03 budget. And that's the result of not being able to close that budget and having to borrow the money in order to do it.
It was done in a 10-year fashion. I think it was roughly $430 million. It was done right at the end of the 2003 session. It was not a good thing.
I mention it because there's a possibility we could be in the same boat this year.
That would be unfortunate.
Yes, it would.
That was one of the many reasons why the state got downgraded, because that is really considered poor financial management. Unfortunately, the state was not in a position to do much. There was not much time left in the fiscal year. But it was the fact that we haven't used that mechanism again, and we've been building reserves. It's actually got us our credit rating improvement. So it was done in the past. I hope we don't have to do that again.
Thank you.
I'll leave it at
that. You got to the answer I was hoping you were going to give us.
Okay, so these are the various types that have been approved, and it was before the economic stimulus package that's being debated in the legislature at the moment, so we can incorporate that in the future. I think it's important to note that we used a December revenue forecast for this report. We didn't have any better information, and I think that most would agree that the next forecast is going to be lower. And so we want to temper our remarks because we will be updating this for you if that's appropriate, to give you the new numbers once we have better information. We also use a relatively high interest rate compared to historical because we were nervous about the direction of long-term interest rates in the future. And this is what you're asking for. So at the end of 2009, based on what's been authorized and what we'll sell, and we will tweak this because we have to incorporate the new revenues, but also if we sell some economic stimulus bonds, but before we knew about both of those things, we would have been at 3.89% in terms of our debt service as percentage of general fund revenues. So obviously, if the revenues go down, the denominator shrinks, that ratio is going to go up. And there will be some incremental increase if we issue more bonds. But again, in 2009, we don't make the debt service payments until fiscal year 2010. But using this 5% approach, we just go out 6 years, and you see that over that 6-year period, primarily with a lot of capacity in 2014 and 15, we have $3.3 billion. The committee simply takes that number, divides by 3. Again, we could use a slightly slower number and just say, okay, only exactly up to the 5%. But I think that the goal here is this smoothing approach, which is that we're constantly refining these numbers. And as revenues go up or down, we're trying to think about in the long term, you know, a 5% average over a longer term period of time. We were worried. We didn't know exactly what the economic forecast would be. So we ran some sensitivity analyses. And we said, okay, what if over the 6-year horizon, general fund revenues on average declined by 10%. That means every single year 10%, not just 10% in the next biennium. And what you see is that we should, the 1.1 drops to roughly $927 million, or about $200 million less per biennium. We did a similar analysis for, even though we use a conservative interest rate, what if we're wrong and the long-term interest rate over this next 6-year period is higher than we think? And that would drop us by about $100 million for biennium. So we think that the revenue particularly is the thing to think about. And the commission recommended in their report that the revenue committees allow us to come and testify simultaneous with the revenue forecasts once they're released for the March forecast as well as the May forecast, just to give the legislature some additional insight as far as these numbers. Are there any other questions on general fund?
Yeah, Representative Vance.
Back to that last slide, if you might, those parameters of 10%, 10%, 1%, 1% recently would have been tested, at least the interest rates. What's your widest space that you feel comfortable in suggesting might actually happen as to those interest rates?
We're supposed to price bonds the week that Lehman Brothers filed for bankruptcy back in September. And we
not a good week.
It's ironic because if we had just gone ahead, we would have gotten a better interest rate than by waiting a month because it just got worse and worse. But we couldn't know that week. And we saw interest rates spike roughly 1 full percentage point from where they'd been. But you've got to understand that interest rates for tax exempts, this is the long end of the tax exempts, was the lowest it had been in over 25 years. So, you know, we're still talking about borrowing under 6%. It's just that we got real spoiled because we were borrowing well under 5%. So it's all kind of relative. This is not the 80s. This is not 13%, you know, kind of world. I've been worried about that and thinking a lot about that, whether we're in an inflationary or deflationary world. And I guess I was just at a lecture the other night where at least the gentleman who spoke, who just got a Nobel Prize, suggested we were in a deflationary world. Having said that, interest rates right now, we're going to sell COPs. The second week in February. These will have an average, you know, some of them are shorter and some of them are longer, but we're still looking under 5%. And that includes a component that's taxable. I can't guarantee it because we'll get there because there's still a lot of supply, but you need to understand that the long-term treasury rate is extremely low. Generally, a tax exempt is 90% of whatever that rate is all the way out the yield curve. But we're at 150, 180% of a treasury rate right now. That's why I say, all things being equal, our long-term interest rate that we're borrowing at hasn't changed. It's just that it should be so much lower, but there's so many fewer buyers in our market that we're seeing those kind of crazy spreads that don't make sense when you really think about it, because this is a tax-exempt instrument.
Representative Brown, call up. Thank you for that. Has volatility decreased?
No. What's been happening is a lot of people pulled out of the market during this craziness of the fall, and all those people still need to borrow money. And then all the investors who pulled out, they're sitting there with money on the sidelines. So we had a fairly good second half of December and early January. And then, of course, everybody saw that we had a really good second half of December. So then more and more deals started coming into the market, and so then everything backed up. So I'm used to, like, interest rates moving a couple of basis points, maybe every week or two. We're talking 30 basis points jump, like, and it's just the luck of the draw. Did you hit the good day, the bad day? And we don't do market timing. We have bond calendar. We have so many people involved. We just have to roll them out. We do the best we can within each day we're in the market. But it's an awfully tough time for us compared to what we're used to.
Thank you.
I do feel confident, I should say, in closing, because we've looked back 5 years historically, and we've added 100 basis points just for this model. And we may be off by, as I said, if it goes up to, you know, we're using 5.53 as our long-term rate. And this model shows you, okay, if it's 6.53, well, we really haven't even been in the 6% range since for most of this decade. So we'll, I guess we will see. That's why we do it annually, and we update the model.
Good. While we're talking about this subject, it occurs to me that one of the ways you deal with a situation that's volatile is in your rights to refinance later if you choose to do that. Could you tell us what the rules are around refinancing these kinds of instruments?
Well, we are allowed under federal tax law to do one advance refunding prior to the call date on the bonds. We typically have a 10-year call. So we do get another bite at that apple. So, but you also have to have treasury rates just in the right place because you have to fund an escrow at the same time. Your tax exempt rates and treasury rates have to be in the right ratios. We have very few advance refundings going on throughout the state. Now, about four years ago when I first moved here, I think my office processed the approvals for about 85 of them. So it just sort of depends on that combination. But we will, over the course of that 10 years, I'm sure, be in that environment again. Well, so that's the saving grace, is that we are always looking at each of our bonds. Our underwriters are more than happy to tell us about opportunities for them to refinance and earn a commission if we can lower our borrowing costs. And we have a rule of thumb where we don't really refinance anything unless we can get present value savings at a minimum of 3%, although we shoot for 5% generally in terms of savings. So that's absolutely true. So there's chances to restructure when the market is in our favor.
Thank you. So if Professor Krugman is right, the opportunity will come to refinance what you're borrowing now.
We'd rather refinance everything eventually.
We'd rather he weren't right, actually. Right. But if he is right, at least you'll be able to get your interest rate down.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Lottery-backed debt. As of June 30th, we had $700 million in lottery bonds. Now, that's kind of surprising because there's been a lot of lottery bond authorizations, but we had, until recently, kept the term of our lottery bonds at 15 years. So that allows for a faster recycling and reprocessing of lottery capacity. And this is just a list of some of the kinds of things that have been financed over the years with lottery. We, again, use the December forecast for the next 6 years. We assume level debt service. Now we're using a 20-year horizon rather than 15. And we included the authorizations the 07 legislature had included, which was $486 million in lottery revenue bonds. We use the same interest rate. But here's a slightly different twist in terms of the forecast ratio. Under our master indenture, we cannot pledge more than one quarter of net lottery proceeds that come to the state as far as making debt service payments. So we reverse that percentage and we say coverage. So you have to have four times coverage. Now, some, it was only three states that have sold lottery revenue bonds. We were the first in the country to try it. At the time that we first did it, we thought four times coverage was conservative to get the kind of credit rating we needed. And that's why we also did 15 years. The program's proven itself successful. We're a triple A, believe it or not, for our lottery revenue. We're a double A for our general obligation bonds, which is an interesting phenomenon, because our coverage has been up in the neighborhood of seven times coverage.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Your master indenture on the bonds that I've assisted in placing, we didn't have a master indenture. So you tell me why, what you're referring to.
When you sell revenue bonds, you have to actually create a master trust indenture. And that's, because you don't have the full faith and credit of the state. So you have to make, you draft, it's a contract, if you will, with investors that a trustee manages. So that's what I'm talking about. And that's what where you pledge the revenues. We pledge we will not issue additional bonds unless we have at least four times coverage. We could, Florida, for example, has gone to a three times coverage. They're not quite at the same credit rating we are. My point isn't that we should change this ratio. My point is that we probably have more capacity than I'm showing you if we're willing to have a slightly higher interest rate and slightly lower credit rating. So we've taken a pretty conservative approach to the method that we've packaged up our lottery revenue bonds.
Representative Benz.
So how does this legislative body comment, drive, direct the terms of the master indenture, if at all?
Well, those were established initially back when the program was established. So that once it's established, we just continue to sell bonds under that. If you were to say you wanted to sell $800 million in lottery revenue bonds and our capacity told you we only had four, then I'd have to obviously come up with a senior and subordinate lien structure so that I could somehow figure out how to accommodate the legislative intent. Actually, that was done for ODOT because the legislature approved far more bonds than the senior lien indenture could possibly have accommodated. So we moved to a senior subordinate lien with different coverage requirements successfully for ODOT about 3 years ago. So it's really indirectly is more people trying to solve the problem of, boy, they want us to sell this much bonds and our revenues wouldn't allow us to do it. We were able to still get very good credit ratings, but it just took some time to think through how to achieve that, primarily through selling bonds over time and selling bonds as the revenues grew to accommodate and using, we use variable rate debt. There's a variety of other things we've done to make it work.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is a chart that shows you, the purple shows you exactly how much lottery bond debt was outstanding. The little dashed line shows you what the coverage requirements are minimum. And then you can see what the actual coverage requirements were at the top. So despite the fact that we've been continuing to authorize and issue lottery bonds, we've been recycling that debt. Our coverage has gone up. And remarkably, once we had video lottery, you see how the coverage went shooting straight up. Because the revenues for lottery revenue came in, I think, about roughly 25%, if I'm not mistaken, higher than had been prior to that. That was roughly about the time we were able to get that improved credit rating. The tricky part will be, of course, will lottery revenues continue at that same robust pace, or will they start declining, both due to the economy, changes in smoking allowances, et cetera, and that's some concern, I'd say, the commission had, which was that they were a little more nervous about the long-term prospects for the lottery and were concerned that we not to get too close to our coverage, at least at this point. This is the forecast. We will be at 7.4 times coverage. Again, that was before the economic stimulus package going through the legislature, so these numbers will need to be tweaked. And you can see we have a lot of capacity because of our high coverage. But if we go to four times coverage, then we sort of suck it all down, and we don't have a lot of capacity until the end of the six-year forecast. So, again, the commission suggests a more moderate one-third, one-third, one-third approach so you don't use up all your capacity at any one point in time. That roughly allows us to do about $400 million in lottery revenue bonds per biennium. If there's a 10% decline in the revenue forecast, that drops the forecasted capacity by about $80 million per biennium. And you can see that a slight change in interest rates, it has an impact, but it's not nearly as significant. We used to run numbers about taxable, tax-exempt, because taxable doesn't usually represent too large a percentage of our overall portfolio, and we usually put those bonds first so that they are at the lowest end of the yield curve. It really hasn't had much impact on our overall interest cost to date. And, of course, if you did all $400 million taxable, then I'd have to withdraw my comments, but in general, it seems that the legislature has chosen to use most of the debt that's been approved has been tax exempt. Moving along, if there's no questions. The difficulty to compare ourselves to other states is that every state has a different way of doing its general obligation bonds. Some of the dots in different states are in the general fund or they're not. So the rating agencies have developed this thing called the net tax-supported debt. It's a way for them to look apples to apples across all 50 states. For our state, that means all of our general fund supported debt that I've shown before, the balance of our pension obligation bonds, because only 38% are general fund supported. But to do this analysis, they have to throw the whole thing into the pot. All of our COPs, our lottery revenue bonds, and our highway user bonds. When you add all that together, that is roughly at $6 billion. So we talked in the very beginning about the $9 billion in debt. Of that $9 billion plus the state has outstanding, just around $6 billion of it is tax-supported for one form or another. And you can see our ratios. We also pulled out the pension obligation bonds to show you our ratios because not every state chose to sell pension obligation bonds, although there's many states that have pension obligation liabilities on their balance sheets. They're just unfunded, and they're paying into their PERS or whatever systems they have. Because of that, Moody's often does Moody's medians, and I think that's actually one of my performance statistics for my agency. The problem is it's only the publicly offered debt. And so the green bars show you what the Moody's medians have been for debt as a percentage of personal income for the last decade. And you can see that we were right at the median until 2003. The blue on top is when we sold the pension obligation bonds, and the dark blue is everything but the pension obligation bonds. So you can see even excluding the pension obligation bonds, we're above those medians, primarily because of the OTIA work that we've been doing. The problem, as I mentioned, though, is that it doesn't really account for the unfunded liability. So about a year and a half ago, Standard & Poor's published...
That's other people's unfunded liability.
Exactly.
This liability is funded.
In our case. But the thing is, we're just looking at debt outstanding in the capital markets. So we went from about 38th position...
The green bar...
Is the median
everybody, including those states with unfunded liabilities.
Sure. That's correct. That's the 50-state median.
Thank you.
So what we've complained, because we went from 38th place to 11th place, even though we thought we were doing something that was fiscally prudent. But that's just Moody's medians. That's how they work. What Standard & Poor's did was, and it was really difficult to do, is they were able to get the balance sheets, the unfunded actuarial studies for all 50 states in terms of their pension systems. They took that information plus the outstanding publicly offered debt, combined the two together, and came up with these debt ratios to start looking at overall liability. And what this shows in this chart is that Oregon was the third best in the country. The two that were better than us didn't really have pension programs for their employees. And the reason is that our PERS system was so overfunded relative to all the other PERS that despite the fact that our debt ratios had gone up, when you look at all of the liability, we really ended up on top. Mm-hmm. The national median for this particular ratio was 5.7%, and you can see that even under the AAAs, some AAAs were very low like we were, but the median among the AAAs, and there were eight or nine of them at the time that I did this report, was 4.7%, which kind of gives you a hint that we do have debt, but I think it's well managed, and that we've done a good job of trying to fund our pension system, to reform our pension system, and so in that regard, we're far, far ahead of many other states around the country. This is just a list of some of the non-tax supported debt and the different programs that that we finance. And so these are really our conclusions. As I mentioned, we'd like, if it's minimal to the committee, to come back and give you a quick summary update of some of our charts to show you how the revenue forecast affects the capacity forecast. And with that, I thank you very much for your time. And any other questions?
Thank you. Other questions? I assume the members of the committee absorbed all of this and understand it thoroughly. I will admit that I only get about two-thirds of it, so every time we do a presentation like this, I learn a little bit more, and I appreciate it. It's been my view for some time that Oregon does a good job of managing debt, and that says most about the treasurer's office and probably a little bit about the legislature. In either we've been able to make good decisions or you've been able to talk us into making good decisions, and we appreciate it. Anything else?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Just to mention to the committee that the report, the actual report that is not a presentation, is on the web. Would you tell them what's the website, please? Uh-huh.
Well, if you go to the state treasurer's website, there was an email sent to each legislative office with the link, but it's on the treasurer's website. We also have hard copies in my office for anybody. We're happy to provide them. So perhaps if members of the committee are interested, Mazin, just let me know and I'll ship some over to you.
Senator Metzger and I, while we were working in this commission, indicated that we did not think that every legislator needed a printed copy of the report, and that legislators who wanted one could ask for one, otherwise could find it on our websites, on the state websites. I think that, from my personal point of view at least, we should be doing that with a lot of reports that we get in hard copy, and then they sit on the shelf. I find it, frankly, easier to find reports on the Internet than I do to figure out where I've stashed the thing.
You're here, Mr. Chair.
And so I personally would prefer that we continue doing it this way and save the printing costs. I don't see anybody really strongly objecting to that.
I'll send an email with a website for everybody.
With the link. And it is one of our problems in the state system. This isn't your problem. It's the way we manage the state websites, is that reports are sometimes difficult to find because of the layers of menus you have to go through. We do need to get the state webmaster, if we have such a person, to figure out a better way to do that so that they're more accessible. But once we get that done, never printing another report would be the preferred approach, I think. Anything else this morning? We really appreciate the report. Thank you very much. Be sure to ask questions of the treasurer's office when you have them. And we got a little bit early this morning. Thank you very much. Committee is adjourned.